Good afternoon. I'm ADC appointed counsel for Mr. Wilson. This is a post-conviction case on a denial of a Rule 35C hearing. The district court denied the defendant's Rule 35C motion without an evidentiary hearing, and the issue on appeal is whether the district court was wrong in doing that, and that is something that the Court of Appeals reviews de novo. The law is, as set forth by the Supreme Court in White versus District Court and the other cases I cited, that the district court is required to hold one of these evidentiary hearings unless it can tell from the record that there's no set of facts that the defendant could prove at the evidentiary hearing that would support his claims. And the two key claims that the defendant put in his motion that I filed on his behalf, he also filed a kind of a rambling pro se motion, excuse me, those two issues were whether he was competent at the time he waived counsel. And by competent, I mean, first of all, whether he was even competent to stand trial at all, and second of all, whether he could have been competent to have represented himself. And there were two times where he waived counsel, 2 years apart, and there's different psychological and medical issues that were pertinent to both times. And then the second but related issue is whether his public defenders and ADC counsel were ineffective by withdrawing when he asked them to without requesting the competency evaluation, because had they requested the competency evaluation, it is more likely than not that he would have been incompetent and that he wouldn't have waived counsel. That, you know, all of his problems with counsel stem from his psychological problems, and once he became suitably medicated by the fall of 2004, he no longer wanted to represent himself. He was thinking clearly, and he said repeatedly on the record, every time there was a hearing, I don't want to represent myself, I don't want to represent myself.
Trenberg, you'd agree, though, that if he made one valid waiver of counsel, that waiver operates for the rest of the case?
You mean if the first waiver was valid, even though the second waiver wasn't?
Yes.
Well, that's why I argue that both waivers were invalid for about the same reason, for the medications that he should have been on but wasn't on. And that was true both times. The first time in 2001, he waived counsel in December of 2001 and asked the public defenders to withdraw. Was given the Arguello advisement, and the court found his waiver was knowing and intelligent, but didn't take any testimony as to his psychological issues. Now, there's two things that should have happened here. First of all, his public defenders should have been aware of his mental history. I mean, he had been a judge criminally insane by a California court and had spent almost all of his adolescence and early 20s in a mental hospital. That should have raised a huge red flag with them had they investigated his background, and would have caused them to request a competency.
Well, the competency hearing was requested specifically by the court in January or February of 2002.
Exactly.
And he was found competent to proceed after that was...
Right. And what I specifically put in the 35C report, and these are the key facts that need to be litigated at the evidentiary hearing, was before, in December 2001, before he went down to the state hospital, he was not on any medications. Once he got to the state hospital, he was put on these medications that calmed him and restored him to competency. And by the time they got around to actually evaluating him, which was 5 or 6 weeks later, they could determine that he was in fact competent. And the very same thing happened a couple of years later when he was taken off that same medication. He slid back in incompetency pretty rapidly.
Let me ask you about the 2001 waiver. What prejudice, if any, can you point to in the record that he suffered as a result of being unrepresented for several months?
Well, I mean, he wasn't represented just for several months. He was forced to represent himself at trial.
I understand, but we're talking about the 2001 waiver now, which was well before trial. Trial wasn't until 2004.
Well, if the court is saying that that 2001 waiver acted as a valid waiver all the way through 2004, then the prejudice was regardless of what happened later, then he can be forced to have represented himself at trial, even though maybe his 2003 waiver wasn't valid.
So if we assume that the 2001 waiver was invalid, for some reason. Is there any harm that flows from that since he was immediately given counsel when he got back?
He wasn't immediately given counsel. It was several months later. And then by the time he did receive that counsel, he was off his medications again because the jail refused to give him the prescribed medications from the state hospital.
But I'm not understanding what harm the waiver itself caused during that brief period he was unrepresented. Because once he got counsel again, what, doesn't the harm go away? Unless he made some statement that was used against him during that period he was unrepresented, or unless he failed to get a witness that was later declared dead, or I'm sorry, was dead, or couldn't testify for some reason. I'm struggling with what harm existed following that 2001 waiver.
Well, I'm not arguing that in that narrow period from December 2001 through, I think, April 2002, when Ross Wilson entered his appearance, that something happened that was irreparable. What happened was that he then relapsed into incompetency. And then when Ross Wilson withdrew and was replaced by Susan Martin, Susan Martin did the same thing. She failed to request a competency hearing when the defendant asked her to withdraw. And by that time, he was off those medications that were prescribed to him at the state hospital. And once he got back on them, after his second competency evaluation, he was restored to competence. So there's a big factual issue there as to whether he was competent the second time he waived counsel when Susan Martin withdrew. And the prejudice then is he was forced to represent himself in a first-degree murder trial pro se.
Let me ask you this, counsel. Under your theory, does the Edwards standard of competence apply as of the dates he waived counsel or as of the date he actually went to trial in 2004? In other words, couldn't he have waived counsel under the Godinez standard in 2001 and 2003, and on the date of trial, that's when the Edwards standard applies?
Well, except for the fact that there was months of pretrial hearings, and while he was pro se, after Susan Martin withdrew, there were a lot of key evidentiary hearings regarding discovery and documents and subpoenas of witnesses. Some of those I raised on direct appeal and lost because the issue wasn't properly preserved, and I put in the 35C motion that his inability to marshal all of that information necessary to preserve his pretrial rights, you know, goes to part of the prejudice of being forced to represent himself while he was incompetent.
Let me follow that up if I could, please. It seems to me there were at least two rulings below that he was competent, and there were two rulings that he made a valid waiver of his right to counsel. Why couldn't she simply have appealed any one or all of those four rulings on direct appeal?
Because I could practically write your decision now. I would say on the record before us, there's insufficient grounds that was an abuse of discretion. And the reason why there were insufficient grounds is because the defendant, the incompetent, mentally ill defendant who has trouble, you know, seeing the big picture and pulling everything together that he needs to pull, did not make a sufficient record. Therefore, I couldn't raise it on direct appeal. I needed to make a better record first, which is why I immediately filed this 35C and asked to have an evidentiary hearing on all his issues regarding the medication, how much he was on, when he was put on, when it was switched, the details of his conviction for criminal insanity in California, his medical records back when he was a teenager, when he was incarcerated in the state hospital, and all of that stuff that should have been put in the record in 2001 in order to have a sufficient record for the Court of Appeals to review whether the district court abused its discretion in finding a valid, knowing, and intelligent waiver of counsel, given the defendant's long and serious history of mental illness. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my last 5.5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. I would like to focus on this December 2003 waiver.
he received two Arguello advisements in December 2003 and by the conflicts court and by the trial judge. And if you look at the record of those waivers, his responses to the questions were appropriate. There was nothing there to alert the trial court that he was not competent. In fact, the trial court made a specific finding, in addition to finding a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver, that he was competent. And then most of this information that the defendant claims was necessary to present in a 35C proceeding, they had, I think, 3 or 4 days, maybe 5 days, worth of hearings on these medication changes in September of 2004 before the defendant went to trial. So the trial court here had sufficient information before it to deny this 35C without a hearing. It had made findings repeatedly that the defendant was competent, and it had all this information about the medication switch or the medication changes, which I recall wasn't at this point a medication switch, but the manner in which they were administrating the medications, crushing them at one point or not giving them a time-released version, but front-loading the medication. And there were doctors at that hearing who I believe said would not have affected his competency. So the trial court had all this information, and the post-conviction court was the trial judge here. So not only did it have all this information in the record about what the defendant was claiming the jail was doing in changing his medication, but it had its own memory of dealing with the defendant at trial. And it was my understanding that the argument here was more that the trial court would have had made a different determination had it had the benefit of the Edwards decision. But here in denying the 35C motion, the trial court did have the benefit of Edwards. So I think this is a case where the trial court properly denied it without a hearing because it had all this information that was presented in the 35C motion.
You didn't argue successiveness. Is there a reason you didn't argue
that
the defendant's motion here was
successive? That it was successive to what he presented on direct appeal?
Competence. No, successive as to competence, that he should have raised it on direct appeal.
I considered that, and I looked at the idea. I thought what he was trying to raise was that this new, I thought it was kind of a new law had come out that maybe had changed things, whether it applies retroactively or whether it is indeed a new law. I don't think it is, because the U.S. Supreme Court did not delineate a new standard for competence. It just said, we're going to leave this to the discretion of the trial judges. The U.S. Constitution does not prohibit a trial judge from requiring a defendant to have an attorney when he's borderline competent. And I don't think that was so much a new rule, but I did not make that argument. In reviewing for oral argument, I thought, well, that was a possibility here, but I didn't do it in the first instance. So, and I do think most of this information was available to the defendant, obviously, on direct appeal. The only difference here is the Edwards decision.
You represented?
At which competency are you hearing, Your Honor? That was the
second.
The second competency hearing. He was still, I think his attorneys withdrew around the same time. Let's see, he waived his right to counsel in 2001 and 2003. 2003 valid waiver. Second competency hearing was in May of 2004 when he was representing himself.
I think the question was he represented during the proceedings in 2003 when he purported to waive counsel? And he was, wasn't he, until
yes.
Counsel withdrew?
Right, and he asked to fire counsel. And as I recall, it was because, and this was a continuing problem, 7-8 attorneys he had here, they weren't getting along with his investigator. And I think that was the reason why counsel withdrew, why he asked for counsel to withdraw, because counsel wasn't doing what his investigator thought was appropriate.
What effect is, if any, does it have that the defendant was, in 2004, in the September-October timeframe, told to file a written motion if he wanted to assert that he was incompetent to make the 2003 waiver, and he declined to do so?
I think he waived it. I mean, I'm sure his argument at this point would be he was incompetent, which is why he didn't do it.
But the termination of the medications, though, was in the September-October 2004 timeframe as well.
Correct.
And the trial court, as you said, had a number of days of hearing on that issue and found, I think, as I recall the record, said specifically that he is getting the appropriate medications, and I continue to find him competent.
Correct, Your Honor. Because, and as I recall from those hearings, he wasn't necessarily looking for the trial court to find him incompetent. He wanted to make sure that the jail was giving him the proper medications, and he had some dispute with the doctors as to whether the medications the jail was giving him were comparable to the medications he was receiving when he was in the state hospital. I think he, as a matter of fact, tried to withdraw it. He started to say, I'm incompetent, or they're making me incompetent. And then when the court at one point said, well, do you want to undergo another competency evaluation, or started to approach that idea, he backed off from it a little bit. But, and I think when we read the court's order here, and the court had the opportunity to observe him all during the trial, the court noted that it did find him competent throughout these proceedings. And that's why we didn't need a hearing sort of to rehash all this stuff that had happened now at this point, 9 years before.
I have a question concerning the Edwards issue. You read Edwards not to require a different standard for representation of oneself than from the competency to stand trial, correct?
No, I read Edwards to say to not provide a particular standard. What Edwards says, in my reading of Edwards, is we'll leave that up to the trial judges to make that call. They're better able to see the defendant, and I think they use the word fine-tune, what kind of assistance the defendant might need, but they specifically decline in Edwards to adopt any particular standard, which I think the dissent in Edwards points out. We're just going to leave it up to the trial court to determine whether this particular defendant is capable of representing himself. And I know one thing in Edwards they point to as being competent to represent himself is be able to perform basic tasks of a trial, like voir dire and make motions and argue points of law, but they never articulate a particular standard for competency. They leave that up to the trial court.
If they leave it up to the trial court, how would you apply Edwards in this situation?
The trial court here believes the defendant was competent to represent himself at trial under the Edwards standard.
So even assuming that Edwards has some kind of mandate, the trial court complied with that here?
Correct. I've noticed in other states where they've looked at this issue when it's been on direct appeal, they've remanded it to the trial court because there was some concern that the trial court thought that it was required to allow the defendant to represent himself because he met the Dusky standard. And so in those cases, in some defense counsel cites in her reply brief, when you look at them, that was the idea. We're unsure here whether the trial court did this because it thought it had to do this. In this case, in this 35C, of course, the defendant is aware of the Edwards decision because that's what the defendant relied upon in his 35C motion. Instead, I find the defendant was competent throughout these proceedings.
Did he specifically reference the Edwards decision and the Edwards idea of a somewhat different standard of competence?
His exact words were, the court has considered the entirety of the court file, the evidence presented at trial, the authorities and arguments contained in the written submissions of the parties, as well as the case law applicable. That's what the court said. The court didn't specifically say Edwards, but the court didn't refer to Dusky or any of the other standards either, and it just concluded with the court found him competent to proceed.
Edwards had...
Well, I'm talking on the 35C order.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
So the court was presented with that idea that, so this isn't like some of these cases where the appellate court doesn't know whether the court thought it was bound by.
Oh, let me ask you, does that indicate that the court said, yes, Edwards does have a different standard, and I will apply that standard? Or does it indicate that, no, I don't think Edwards applies here, so I'm not applying that standard?
It doesn't indicate either way, but just based on the court's final, I found him competent throughout these proceedings.
What standard?
Correct. But the court does say it considered all the authorities presented by the defendant, and a big part of this argument on the 35C was this Edwards standard. And I think by finding that the defendant, three judges found the defendant properly waived his rights and gave him proper Arguello advisements, I think that in itself is a pretty high standard, finding a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver.
If you're competent.
Correct. But I think even a competent person, of course, can't make a knowing and intelligent and voluntary waiver. So I think that's almost a higher standard than saying you're competent if all this follows with your waiver. And as I said, the court's in the position, that trial court was in the position of talking to this defendant and seeing him every single day and how he acted. And I pointed out also in the brief what the defendant did during trial, which does not suggest that he had an inability to perform basic trial tasks, quite the opposite. He presented a coherent theory of defense, cross-examined witnesses, conducted voir dire, made motions, etc. So enough was here for the trial court to deny this on the record it had. It would have been simply rehashing some of the stuff it had heard, and that was September, October hearings. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask that the trial court's order be affirmed. Thank you.
First of all, on the issue of successiveness and waiver, even if the court finds that my first issue is waived because it could have been raised on direct appeal, the second issue is not, and that 35C38, that an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, notwithstanding that it could have been raised on direct appeal, may be raised in a subsequent 35C.
Let's assume that his counsel was ineffective in not asking for a competency hearing before they withdrew. That's the withdrawal that occurred in 01 or 03?
Both, Your Honor. I think at both times there would have been a serious issue as to whether he was competent or not, and then a better record could have been made on what medications he was on and what medications he should have been on. In 2001, and this is what I'll have to present at the evidentiary hearing if we get to have it, once he got down to the state hospital, he was put on that triliptitol, or I'm not pronouncing it right, that evened out his moods and caused him to not have so many problems and stopped the paranoid delusions, which was causing him to be incompetent. And so if that had happened, then once he was restored to competency, he wouldn't have waived counsel. You know, both times, once he was restored to competence, he said, I want a lawyer. And that's when he got Ross Wilson the first time. And then the second time, the judge didn't give him a new lawyer after he was restored to competency the second time.
That's in 04.
In 04. And no one's denying that he was dusky competent in 2004 during the trial. So all those arguments by the Attorney General are not relevant to the issue I am raising. He most certainly was competent to stand trial once he was restored to competence the second time. However, that doesn't mean that he was competent to represent himself, and the court never made any findings along those regards. Now, regarding the medication switch, the Attorney General just argued that, well, that switch didn't happen until 2004. We don't know that. That is not in the record. Everybody's just guessing. You know, they were switched sometime while he was in the jail, and we don't know when. And that is a key and pivotal factual issue that must be subpoenaed from the jail records and presented at the evidentiary hearing.
I thought there was testimony in 04 that either there hadn't been a medication switch or the consensus of the medical professionals was it didn't matter.
No, the testimony in 2004 was that crushing his medication and giving it all at once or not giving him the time release was not affecting his competency. No one disputed the fact that the jail took him off the triliptitol, and it was that specific medication that he needed to remain competent. The jail didn't want to give him that because it was too expensive. They put him on something else. I think it was Thorazine, and that just caused him even more problems. But the issue of crushing the medication versus giving him the time release.
So you're saying that in the 04 hearing, nobody brought up an elicited testimony on either the fact of a change medication or its medical significance?
Well, no one brought up the medical significance of it because the defendant was trying to represent himself pro se. And there was testimony about the crush versus the time release. And see, this again goes to the defendant being incompetent. You know, incompetent defendants, they get focused on this narrow little thing that's usually not the big picture. And he was so focused on the fact that they were crushing his medication, which was causing him to have headaches. That's all he cared about. And that's what he kept harping on in that 2004 competency hearing.
And he was not represented in that hearing.
He was not represented by counsel. And he lost sight of the bigger picture that long before that time, before he went to the state hospital the second time, the jail switched out his medications. And that could very well have contributed to him relapsing into incompetency. Because there's no doubt, regardless of whether the medications were switched or not, that sometime between 2002 and 2004, he relapsed into incompetency. And the most logical explanation for that is that the triliptitol was switched for the Thorazine. Does the court have any other questions? Then I would ask you to please remand for an evidentiary hearing to determine that list of factual issues that I set forth in detail in my briefs. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. Stand submitted.